Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, who is very excited for our Halloween coming up next week. This has always been one of my more favorite times of the year, and Halloween is one reason because I look forward to giving candy out to all the trick-or-treaters out there. On my block here in Gratiot County, we will sometimes get somewhere around 600 to 800 kids, and I'm not making that number up. Sometimes the numbers go even higher, and that's partially due in part to my good friend Rich, who helped design leftoflansing.com. Please subscribe to leftoflansing.com if you haven't already. Anyway, Rich goes all out with his Halloween decorations. And I'm telling you, he doesn't just rely on store-bought decorations. No. He's created many of his own, and he creates such an awesome and spooky Halloween setting to his wife Meredith's chagrin. And I will post a picture along with this week's episode page at leftoflansing.com just so you will get an idea of what exactly I'm talking about. But his house has become a main attraction here in the town, and that's why we have to purchase so much candy for the kids, because they all want to come by and see his house. I love every part of it, although I have to tell you, not looking forward to the 40-degree weather that's being forecasted for the area that day. It's fall, it's Michigan, and we're used to it. I also have to carve out some pumpkins this weekend. I have to watch some of my most favorite scary movies as well. It's always a tradition that I watch the original Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Frederick March, the original Frankenstein, Young Frankenstein, Halloween, Blair Witch, and, of course, Hitchcock's Psycho. Hey, speaking of psychos, MAGA's dear leader, Donald Trump, once again displayed how he is losing his cognitive abilities while giving a speech just the other day as he disclosed something to his fans, something that has eluded him for his entire life. And just listen to how he made this major revelation. Listen.
I'm for us. You know how you spell us, right? You spell us, U.S. I just picked that up. Has anyone ever thought of that? I just picked that up. A couple of days I'm reading and it said us. And I said, you know, if you think about it, us equals U.S. Isn't it? Now, if we say something genius, they'll never say it.
You know, listening back to that clip, I don't know what's more scary. Trump's major revelation or the crowd's response to it. Very unsettling. I mean, how in the world has that guy captured the hearts and minds of 40% of this country? He's losing it. I mean, he's losing it in front of our very eyes. I mean, he's always been deranged and twisted and lacked any sort of moral character, of course, but he's honestly losing it right now. And yet, his voters and supporters in Congress refuse to budge. And speaking of Congress, we finally have a House Speaker again. Yay! This time, it's Louisiana Republican Congressman Mike Johnson, who's an election denier and wants to ban abortion across the entire country, which only goes on to remind all of us how that whole states' rights argument was always a sham and a facade. Just listen to this line of questioning that he gave Dr. Yashika Robinson a few months ago. She's a board member of the Physicians for Reproductive Health. And this was during a committee hearing a few months ago. Listen.
At what point in pregnancy should having an abortion no longer be an option?
As a medical doctor, I understand that every pregnancy is unique and different. I also understand that patients need to have access to care, pregnant people, as the pregnancy progresses, and that may be for various reasons.
Okay, let me ask you, do you support the right of a woman who is just seconds away from birthing a healthy child to have an abortion?
I think that the question that you're asking does not realistically reflect abortion care.
In that scenario, would you support her right to abort that child?
I won't entertain theoreticals.
It's not a theoretical, ma'am. You're a medical doctor.
I am a medical doctor, and that has never happened.
Never happened in your practice, ma'am, but it happens. How about if a child is halfway out of the birth canal? Is an abortion permissible then?
Can you repeat your question?
If a child is halfway delivered out of the birth canal, is it permissible to have an abortion? Would you support the right for an abortion then?
I can't even fathom that ever.
I'm not asking you if you can fathom it. If it occurred, would you support that abortion or not? That's unrestricted abortion, right?
That's a question that I can't imagine. Just like you probably can't imagine what you would do if your daughter was raped. If it hasn't happened, it may be difficult for you.
You're not going to answer this question.
Wow. I mean, Johnson just putting out all kinds of right-wing misinformation and straight-out lies. I mean, stupid hypotheticals that don't happen, but yet that's what the right wing believes, and it's why they are fighting hard to continue to punish women. Well, they're also punishing women for having sex, of course, too. I liked what Washington Post columnist Greg Sargent had to say about Mike Johnson, because I think Greg Sargent is on point here. So listen, he says, people are digging up quotes of Mike Johnson pushing vote fraud lies, but what makes Johnson really scary is how polished he is in creating plausible-sounding legal arguments, not dabbling in a Rudy inky forehead conspiracy nuttiness. He's not vulgar MAGA, he's refined MAGA. Yeah, that's what's scary, all right. And you just know the corporate media, especially the Beltway cocktail circuit media, they will just love him. And they'll love him even more if he punches good old hippies. They'll accept some fascism as long as they get Congress to feed them some more corporate welfare. And if you think I'm joking, listen to this garbage on cable news, this being CNBC.
Ford's proposal, actually, I can see that it adds up to $100,000 a year. And $100,000, look, should everybody make a lot of money? Absolutely. Sean Fain, some news reports say, is making up to $400,000. That's okay, too, because given the fact that they have the CEOs.
Yep.
This is where Ronald Reagan was unbelievably good. He always said the issue in America, work in the American corporate background, is that the workers make so much less than the CEOs. So, I mean, in that sense, I don't want to be too hard on Fame. He's trying to...
Although he did famously the air traffic controller strike, remember?
Well, the government work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I love CNBC's Jim Cramer after being told or reminded about how Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic controllers union. Well, okay. I mean, that's what Ronald Reagan's presidency was all about, giving more power to management and taking all the power away, or as much power as possible, away from the workers. Come on. And Cramer there falsely told CNBC viewers that UAW President Sean Fain earns $400,000, when in reality, he's making half that. But that's what corporate media does, and they want to paint the union in bad light. But it's not working. By the way, special thanks to Distill Social for posting that piece of audio and also for A More Perfect Union. Like I said, though, what corporate media is trying to do, especially on cable news, when it comes to the UAW strike, they're really trying to push the corporate line. It's not working. They see how effective Fain's messaging is with the people, and it's why the UAW walked out of GM's most profitable plant the other day. The big three so far have lost $800 million in this strike, and they realize the people are on the UAW side. And Fain said that GM is behind Ford in its offers to the UAW because it wants to still preserve the two-wage system, which the union wants gone. And GM is also offering the weakest of the 401k contributions compared to Ford and Stellantis. However, GM CEO Mary Barra told investors during an earnings call the other day that GM already has made a record offer and won't sign a contract that jeopardizes the company's future. We will not agree to a contract that isn't responsible for our employees and for our shareholders, Barra said. I mean, they just haven't learned yet. They haven't learned. Mary hasn't learned yet. They have the money, but they refuse to share it with their workers. And again, where is the so-called Working People's Party, the MAGA Republican Party, in this fight? I hear nothing but crickets. Oh, but that's right. They're all for corporations and management. They don't care about workers one bit. Would you like another example? Here, listen to this video by Michigan Senate Republicans. Now, in their tweet corresponding with this video, they wrote, "Michiganders already pay among the highest energy rates in the nation, and we have power outages at double the national average. But that hasn't stopped Lansing Democrats from pushing their Green New Deal that would make energy even more expensive and less reliable." The cognitive dissonance in that tweet alone blows my mind, but let's listen to the video.
First, let's enact a 100% clean energy standard for Michigan.
We are dealing with record inflation right now. The price of gas, the price of groceries and rent have all gone up. And now we're learning it's going to cost us way more to heat our homes this winter.
A new federal report forecasting this winter compared to a year ago, households will spend 10% more for electricity, 27% more for heating oil, and 28% more for natural gas.
Americans are expected to spend $540 on electric bills, 20% more than last year.
Michigan is the worst state in the Midwest for power outages.
Michigan customers experienced an average of 14.6 hours of power outage each year from 2013 to 2021. Now that is double the national average of 7.3 hours.
First of all, on a professional level, horrible sound mixing job there, guys. Get on the ball there, Michigan Senate Republicans. Secondly, everything said in that video is exactly why Democrats are trying to pass meaningful, clean, and affordable energy bills. That video alone just illustrates why we need to change things here. We already pay the highest energy rates in the Midwest, and we are one of the worst states trying to provide reliable energy to customers. That's why Democrats are trying to pass bills making the state carbon-free by 2035 or 2040. That's why Democrats are trying to give more authority to the Michigan Public Service Commission, which oversees DTE and Consumers Energy. The Public Service Commission would have to consider a number of factors from now on when seeking new energy projects or rate hikes, such as climate factors, energy affordability, and equity issues in its decision-making. Why haven't those already been factored in, considering climate change and high energy prices are already here? Republicans, you had 40 years to do something about it. You did nothing. Democrats are trying to find ways to make energy more efficient, including making it more affordable for lower-income families. Democrats are trying to give farmers and landowners the power to play a role in large-scale wind and solar farms. And the best part is that local MAGA governments won't be able to block them. Democrats are trying to require energy providers to achieve an annual energy waste reduction standard of 2%. This will lead to huge savings. I mean, listening to that video, I couldn't tell if that was a Senate Republican video or a DTE or a Consumers Energy political ad. Could you? I couldn't. Republicans are complaining and complaining about high energy costs and unreliable energy, but all they're proposing is more of the same. They don't want to hold utility companies accountable, and if anything, they're trying to give more tax breaks and more authority to energy companies. I was told long ago that if we just kept dropping corporate tax rates, it would lead to huge savings for us here in the long run. How's that working out for you? Coming up, Darrell Slaughter, the Michigan advocate at the Natural Resources Defense Council, returns here on Left of Lansing to discuss the latest on those clean and affordable energy bills moving through the Democratic majority in the state legislature, and we'll also discuss some other clean energy initiatives taking shape by Democrats in Lansing as well. Darrell is one of many just trying to find ways to lead Michigan into the future of clean energy, which will not only help our state environmentally, but also economically. And if you want to help drive young people here to the state, a greener, cleaner economy is just the start we need. You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. Need to give Pat a piece of your mind? Or do you have some stories you think Pat should cover? Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com. And if you have Michigan beer ideas for Pat, he'll love you even more. Now, here's Pat.
Don't forget, if you'd like to continue the conversation, please email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. I always enjoy hearing your takes on anything that I said. And if you have any story ideas or feel like that I'm missing a major story that's happening across the state or the nation, let me know. Again, that's leftoflansing@gmail.com. All right, the Democratic majority in the Michigan legislature is developing new climate and clean energy bills. And while we don't have all the details of what's ultimately going to be in these bills, we do know that these bills are aimed at changing Michigan's energy system and switching from harmful fossil fuel energy to more clean energy standards here in the state. And even more, these bills are also outlining how the state can become more energy efficient in the future. So that way, not only will that help the environment, but it'll help us save some money as well. Joining me to discuss more about this is Darrell Slaughter, who's Michigan's clean energy advocate at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Darrell, thanks a lot for being on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me back.
First of all, before we talk about these bills, what exactly does Michigan's clean energy advocate at the NRDC mean?
So in my role, I work all the levers of government, so interacting with our legislature, our regulatory system, particularly the Michigan Public Service Commission, who is the regulator of our big utilities, but other agencies as well, Eagle and others as well, and working with the governor's office to advance good climate, clean energy policy in our state.
And you've been involved in the inner workings of government, not just on the state level, but also on the local level as well, right?
Correct. Finished up a four-year term at the end of last year as Ingham County Commissioner. Great experience. Whole different set of issues. Some overlap, but yeah, great time doing that.
What do you say about some issues overlap? I mean, I guess maybe in a broader sense, maybe are you talking about how sometimes you just have to find consensus with people to make things work in the end?
I think so. Yeah. A lot of the skills and the aspects of this job, definitely I learned from my time as being a county commissioner. So working with stakeholders, working with colleagues to try to get good policy passed too. But what I also meant too, I know local governments also try to ask, we're trying to move our state to be carbon neutral. I know local governments are also looking at ways that they can do that as well. Ingham County passed a resolution, I believe it was 2 years ago now, to actually get on a path to be carbon neutral, I believe it was by 2040 as well. So, yes, I think it's on all folks' minds, and even local governments are trying to do their due diligence and trying to meet these goals.
Well, there are many individual bills that are being worked on as part of this climate and clean energy package in Lansing, and it's coming down to the wire because, from my reading, the legislature adjourns in November, and I guess that's due to the presidential primary calendar, and that's happening in February here for us in Michigan. And any bill that the governor signs into law has to take 90 days to go into effect. So with that said, and before we go into some specifics, how confident are you that we'll get something done here by November before everything adjourns? And will we have to wait on some other parts being finished up in 2024?
Yeah, I'm an optimist by nature. I feel pretty good about getting something done. I think this process, given with the timeline, I think a lot of folks committed, I think on all sides, to get something done, significant, not just something done, but something significant that actually moves the ball forward in terms of making our state more clean in terms of our energy production there. So, but I know folks are working around the clock, including myself and others, to try to get something hashed out and get something to the governor's desk to sign.
I know one key part that you've been focusing on, Darrell, is on energy efficiency. You talked this about all this when you were on the podcast here before. And, you've been pushing to get some of these standards into the bills. Can you explain to my listeners exactly what kinds of energy efficiency steps that we're talking about?
Yeah, so we already in our state have a certain minimum level of energy efficiency savings that utilities have to meet. So I think folks, your listeners may be familiar with, for example, when consumers or boiler water light comes to their house to offer them, for less new light bulbs or to do a check on how efficient their home in terms of heating. So utilities have had to do this for a number of years. They've done such a great job. It's time to update those standards. So right now on the electric side, so electric utilities across their entire system have to find 1% of savings. So dropping, becoming more efficient by 1% annually. We've been pushing for that to go up to 2% because, especially with the more regulated utilities, like the big ones like DTE and consumers, they have demonstrated that they're capable to hit that 2% there. And then on the gas side, pushed for 1.5% because similar reasoning there. You know, and also in this bill, you know, something that does not exist today, but having a minimal amount of energy efficiency funding going towards low-income folks. So the folks that are more at risk of not being able to pay their bill, the ones, folks who may have more difficulty making ends meet and having to spend more of their income to pay for basic energy needs. So in this bill would establish, you know, we're looking at establishing a minimum amount of funding that utilities have to spend. On the electric side, we've been pushing for 25% of utilities energy efficiency program funding going to a low income. And then on the gas side, 35% there. I think it just makes all the sense in the world to have those minimum standards there. And then there's some workforce components, committing our big utilities to actually build a workforce that is diverse and of the folks that they're actually serving. So folks that reside in the communities that they're actually serving as well, making efforts to do that. So there's some really good pieces potentially to get done, to lock in place with legislation, but that's what we're all working for, working towards to try to get that done before that November 9th deadline.
That's November 9th is the last day in the legislature?
Yes, that is the they certainly could have turned earlier. We obviously not like that, but that is, yeah, November 9th is what we've heard from. It's the last session day.
Okay. And again, this is just different because usually they go through December, but this year they can't, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned the presidential, it's related to those pieces there, so.
Gotcha. You were bringing up how this would help low-income families with some funding and all that. Is this like also in terms of maybe helping low-income families if they wanted to make some kinds of efforts, like maybe, I don't know, off the top of my head, I'm thinking like new windows, for instance, more energy efficient windows and all that. Would that go into helping them in that area?
It would be what they call building shell improvements to make folks' homes, you know, have that insulation in the walls so that folks aren't having to run their furnace on as long. Things like wraps around your pipes, like you said, window improvements too. And we're also pushing for utilities to be able to provide what's referred to as health and safety measures. So when folks go into people's homes to try to do these efficiency upgrades, they also may find the home might have black mold or have holes in their roof. So the utilities would also be officially allowed to devote some funding towards those types of improvements that we know folks across the state desperately need.
Have other states enacted something similar that you're hoping to get passed here when it comes to making the state more energy efficient?
You know, the types of things that we're pushing for are non-common. I mean, I can surely circle back with a longer list of states, but I know the state that probably pops up the closest in my mind is a neighbor of ours, is Illinois. I know Illinois has, you know, in terms of their energy efficiency standards and some of the minimums they have there. We're looking to them and other states who have been pretty progressive in terms of energy efficiency programming and, you know, really trying to meet the needs of ratepayers there. So, yeah, the things we're asking for are definitely within the realm of what other states have done and in some ways goes beyond too.
Darrell Slaughter is Michigan's clean energy advocate at the NRDC, and he is my guest here this week on Left of Lansing. You brought it up in the very beginning, and it's a big part of this bill. It seems like it gets the most attention, I think, and that's the part which says Michigan will be carbon-free by 2035. Darrell, do you think that goal will remain? Are you optimistic, or do you see it sort of getting watered down or pushed back by a few years? Because I've seen the date 2040 pop up once in a while. What's your take?
So, yes, as you mentioned before, and when I was on before, yeah, we were in our coalition was pushing for 2035. That was a date for that 100% clean energy standard. You know, in the latest draft that we've seen and what's been out there is, yes, a moving to 2040, which is not what we would want, but I think it's still a goal and ambitious for our state to be 100% clean by that time. Again, we're still waiting on, you know, as we're in the 11th hour getting new drafts as we speak. You know, we had been pushing for 60% renewable energy standard by 2030. That's been moved to 50% by 2030 there. So again, not, you know, as this process goes, obviously we're pushing for these, you know, more ambitious dates, but, you know, we're landing at these other dates and some other details that are changing as well within this bill. So, but we're continuing to push to make sure that these standards and these timelines remain in the details as well, as much as possible.
Darrell, what do you say to opponents who have been telling their supporters, those who are against these bills, that by making the state carbon free by 2035 or 2040, what have you, and by taking all of these steps, what's going to end up happening is that it's just going to end up costing Michiganders even more money than they're paying for energy, and it really won't help the state in the long term. What do you say to that?
Yeah, what I would say is there's a few things I would say. One, President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, there was billions of dollars dedicated to help lower the cost of clean energy sources to solar, wind, battery storage, which is really going to be a key part of our energy transition there. And so those dollars are not insignificant in terms of dropping the cost curve on renewables as well. Two, we know that, you know, fossil-based fuels, particularly some of those traditional ones, you know, are not as, in some ways, more expensive, and renewables are continuing to be more cost competitive. I mean, this is just, I mean, the commission, Public Service Commission has reported on this, I think, internationally. I mean, some of the more respective energy agencies recognize this. And so we're recognizing that. That's, you know, just a fact that that's the case. And then, three, we know that, you know, the utilities, they are going to be spending a lot more money across in general on their system. And, you know, I think you've seen announcements from, for example, DTs saying they need to spend X number of billions of dollars in order to upgrade their system, you know, for reliability purposes and for their overall functionality. If we're going to be, at least, and speaking for myself, we're going to be spending that type of money. We want to see that system and those investments go into clean energy sources, the most efficient energy sources that we can possibly see. You know, the status quo is just not going to cut it for a variety of reasons. Our climate goals, the longstanding, you know, health effects from carbon-based fuel sources, those sorts of things. The rates are going to go up in general, or the utilities are going to be spending this type of money. We'd rather see it used on sources that are going to be more cost-effective, more cost-competitive, and cleaner for all those reasons I just laid there. So, yeah, I've heard all those types of arguments against moving towards, but, it, you know, in my estimation, they don't hold water.
Again, studies are now showing, we're seeing the numbers, that wind and solar energy is now cheaper than what coal is. And maybe some of that has to do to the Inflation Reduction Act that passed a couple of years ago. That has something to do with it. But still, it is proving to be more cheaper than what coal is. And I don't know how anybody can argue against that.
Yeah, I think innovation. I mean, I think it's a combination of innovation, folks is knowing how to deploy this technology better. Solar panels becoming more efficient, being able to extract more electrons from the sun at a more efficient rate. So, you know, all those sorts of dynamics are playing into why renewables are cost cheaper than coal there. So yes, agree with you 100%.
This leads to my next question. It doesn't necessarily deal with the bills. It's just more opinion, but that's kind of why I have you on too. It's just something that I've brought up, and because I've seen this argued by opponents of clean energy many times. And sometimes to me, it feels like this is kind of, it's like their Hail Mary passing away because they know that they're on the losing side of this. But I've heard people say, we don't want windmills. People don't want solar panels because they're just not aesthetically pleasing to the eye. And I really don't understand that, because I think windmills seem pretty nice to look at compared to a coal-fired power plant. But Darrell, have you heard that argument given to you sometimes, or at least posed to you? And what is your response to that? Because I just always say I'd rather look at a windmill than a coal-fired power plant. But I don't know. That's just me.
I'm in the same camp. I've definitely heard those types of arguments and complaints. And I mean, there's a whole set of folks that would say that. And I think there's a whole other, and I would in some ways say there's more folks in our camp where I think seeing that type of technology deployed out there, I think, you know, in some ways it's, we'd rather see that, you know, as opposed to coal plants, especially as a former elected official. You want to hear folks from all sides, but, you know, definitely have a viewpoint there. But Yeah, like for all the reasons that I listed before, I mean, again, we have climate goals we have to meet. We're dealing with the historic harm that's been done from fossil-based generation. And so to put up maybe with a little bit of aesthetics in order to be able to meet these real goals that make sure that we still have a planet and so people can still live their full lives and be healthy, I think that's a decent trade-off. But, you know, that's just my opinion.
This is something that I didn't bring up before we started recording this interview. So if you can't really talk too much about it, that's fine. But I'm just going to bring it up anyways. There's one part in these bills, and I brought it up in an earlier podcast. It has to deal with the state giving power to the Michigan Public Service Commission to greenlight large scale solar and wind projects. And it would give the commission the power to override local municipalities' zoning powers. And this is being proposed because some local governments, as it's been throughout the news, have been blocking green energy efforts from taking place in their communities here throughout the state. Do you see this as another essential step towards changing our energy grid for the future by giving the Michigan Public Service Commission this kind of power?
At least NRDC hasn't weighed on this set of bills as formally as the climate bills. But what I'll say just generally is that, yeah, it's a real problem. You know, in terms of the utilities, you know, some of the larger third-party developers needing to site, you know, large-scale wind and solar project, it is a problem. I think the way, if at all, we've, you know, in terms of our engagement on this issue, we've said that we need the climate bill package. I mean, we need to set those really good, aggressive standards there. Yeah. But there needs to be some type of fix so that the folks are going to be putting these projects up, that they're not running into these roadblocks, so to speak. And so I'll just say that, yeah, that's a problem that needs to be solved. Again, I know that there's a bill package out there and can't focus on the climate bill, but, you know, at a certain point, you know, we'd love to see them go together. We'd love to see them both because they're both essential, but we'll see. I know that's kind of running a parallel track along with these climate bills as well.
Okay. It's not part of the climate bills, though. It's a separate bill.
Correct.
Gotcha. Yes. Gotcha. Okay. And Darrell, how about holding our utilities accountable? I've got to believe that's something that all Michiganders really want after all the long power outages that so many have experienced here in this past year. I talked about this last week with Democratic State Representative Dylan Wagella. Do you see something meaningful happening on this front in terms of holding our utilities accountable?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to, it would be Senate Bill 502, which would expand Public Service Commission's mandate to consider public interest goals related to climate equity and affordability. I think it would go a great deal, one, to just modernize the commission and make it an agency that actually is focusing on issues that weren't thought of when that statute was first created, which was in the 1930s. And so I think we're living in a much different world today than when the bill was first conceived in the 1930s. And to have a commission to actually have its mandate to consider equity, you know, how our decisions and affecting, you know, the most vulnerable population, or thinking about affordability or our climate goals, I think that's really powerful. I think I may have mentioned previously that I was on, but I am a former staffer at the Michigan Public Service Commission, and it's an incredibly influential, powerful agency that a lot of folks don't know about. They're making this ruling on different decisions that around utility generation decisions, issues related to affordability, you know, you name it. And, you know, to have those types of updates to that agency, I think this really helped set the stage for just for us to transition to a more equitable energy system, make sure that everyone's able to partake in the clean energy transition while still addressing the real needs of low income folks at the same time.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I've kept you past how long I said I keep you. So finally, just can you explain, Darrell, I mean, what this would mean for Michigan and Michiganders if we can get this bill package passed and signed into law? Because I look at these bills as helping us move into the future of energy in terms both environmentally and economically, and that these investments to a cleaner energy grid, in my opinion, will pay dividends in the end for our state.
Absolutely. I would just say that having a good set of climate bills passed will, you know, make Michigan a leader in terms of thinking about how we make clean energy work in our state and actually meet these goals while balancing all the other interests, real life. I mean, these are all real life interests, but how to like do it in a way that, that's considered of all interests there. And so, yeah, I'm staying optimistic that we can get something done before that clock runs out, but we're going to keep fighting the good fight until the very end. So.
All right. Well, it was awesome to have you back on here. Terrell Slaughter is Michigan's clean energy advocate at the NRDC. Keep up the good fight. Hope everything is able to work out. We'll keep our eye open, our ears open to see what happens here. Let's hope that we can get something passed here by that adjournment deadline. And maybe next year, have you come back on here and talk more, okay?
We'd love to.
Listening to Left of Lansing. If the podcast isn't enough and you are in need of more Pat, follow him on Twitter and like him on Facebook. Also, don't forget, you can read more of his thoughts and hear an archive of past episodes on leftoflansing.com.
You know, there's another common sense progressive bill in the state house that would stop or eliminate portions of the homeowners association agreements that are currently in place, which prevent homeowners from making any kinds of energy saving improvements to their homes. Democratic State Representative Ranjiv Puri of Canton has introduced the bill. And according to Michigan Advance's Kyle Davidson, the kinds of improvements that we're talking about here include air or ground source heat pumps, rain barrels, insulation, clotheslines, reflective roofing, energy efficient appliances, solar water heaters, electric charging equipment, energy efficient windows and insulation materials, and solar panels. The bill would also require associations to adopt a written solar energy policy statement within a year of the bill taking effect, and the policy cannot conflict with existing local, state, or federal law and cannot prohibit the installation of a solar energy system. I mean, I have relatives who live in Arizona, and you'll see so many houses out there with solar panels on them. I mean, if that's what residents want, they should be able to do it. I mean, this is a no-brainer, and we should ensure a bill like this reaches the governor's desk. We'll be watching. Time now for a Left of Lansing last call. Speaking of common sense, Michigan Democrats, please show some of that common sense and some spine by passing what the voters passed with Proposal 1 last year, which are strong transparency laws. It's being reported by several news outlets that the state legislature is working on passing government transparency bills, which must be completed by that November deadline that Darrell Slaughter and I talked about. Now, voters passed Proposal 1 back in 2022, which essentially changed the term limits that we had in place to now allowing anyone to spend up to 12 years in the state legislature. But more importantly, the proposal also said, and I'm quoting, that elected state legislative and state executive officials must file annual financial disclosure reports on their income, assets, liabilities, gifts from lobbyists, positions held in certain organizations, and agreements on future employment. I mean, you can understand with that language why voters backed it in blowout fashion as it won with 66% of the vote. I mean, it was the elixir that we needed here in Michigan since our state received an F grade in the 2015 Center for Public Integrity's Government Accountability and Transparency State Rankings. In fact, Michigan ranked dead last on the list. Dead last. Michigan was one of two states which did not require both the governor's office and the legislature to follow Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests when it comes to emails and other documents. Now, before Proposal 1's passage last year, multiple transparency bills passed in bipartisan fashion in the state house. But then Majority Senate Leader Republican Mike Shirky ensured that those bills died in the Senate. But now, Democrats are in charge of the entire legislature for the first time in 40 years, and they have a beautiful opportunity to show everyone that they are all for transparency. However, I'm afraid they're falling just a bit short here. Now, to be fair, they are working with Republicans in both chambers, so give Republicans some credit when credit is due. You know, and in this instance, it is. Although, I really could do without Republican State Representative Bill Schuette complaining about how Democrats are insulting voters since they haven't passed transparency bills yet. Okay, it's nice that Schuette joined in the effort, but please, his daddy and the Republicans had full governmental power the 8 previous years before Gretchen Whitmer got there, not to mention 40 straight years that they had power in the entire legislature, and they didn't do anything about transparency. I mean, I don't recall his daddy putting public pressure on Mike Shirky to allow those bills to pass in the Senate. So please, Bill and some other Republicans out there, enough with the projection. Now, that being said, Democrats do indeed have another wonderful chance to demonstrate how they believe in the people and that they will make Michigan officials more accountable to the people they serve. So, in order to be compliant with what the voters passed last year, bills have been unveiled in the state Senate, which would make Michigan the 49th state to require all lawmakers and statewide officials to disclose their financial dealings. And according to Bridge Magazine, these bills make all officials open up their finances of any income source that total $1,000, and this also includes stocks and bonds and liabilities over $10,000. But unlike Congress and many other states, these bills would not force officials to report a value range on all income sources. For example, as Bridge Magazine's Lauren Gibbons reports, government transparency advocates argue that it is important for the public to know whether a lawmaker voting, for example, on a proposal to provide business incentives to a particular company holds $1,000 in stock in that company or $10,000. And Nicholas Pidgeon, executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, told Laura Gibbons in that Bridge Magazine story, if there isn't an itemized disclosure or at least a categorical disclosure of the source earning long-term income, this would be a very weak law compared to the rest of the country. And on top of that, Proposal 1 also required lawmakers and officials to report gifts from lobbyists or their agents. However, it appears the bills in the state Senate kind of skirt that provision a bit by refusing to place those high-priced traveling junkets. You know, like the junkets disgraced former House Speaker and alleged groomer Republican State Representative Lee Chatfield enjoyed from various nonprofits while allegedly running a criminal enterprise, not to mention sexually abusing his sister-in-law when she was 15 years old, again, allegedly. Now, under these bills, those junkets can still happen. That is a problem. And again, to be fair, there are parts in these bills where the language actually goes a bit further than what Proposal 1 said, like requiring officials to report their spouse's incomes and assets. But again, the bills don't go all that far because they don't force officials to report on all of the spouse's incomes and assets if they don't directly help that official. Okay, I'm sorry, but that seems like a huge loophole that many will gladly utilize. And whatever is agreed upon in the end, the fines for failing to meet these requirements ought to be harsh. I mean harsh. These lawmakers always expect us to live by the rules they set for us. Well, then, damn it, they must live by our rules that we set for them. Again, this is a perfect opportunity for Democrats to show that they are on the people's side. And this isn't a left or right issue. It's not a left or right issue. Everyone wants transparency. Although I am wondering who are the third of Michiganders who voted against Proposal 1. Very interesting. But we didn't pass this initiative just so we can do the bare minimum to match other states' transparency laws. We want Michigan to be the leader and the gold standard, not just when it comes to education, the environment, workers' rights, union rights, LGBTQ plus rights, or abortion rights, but we also want to show the country that we believe government should work not just for the connected, the rich, and the donor base. Michigan can show the entire country that we believe in government working for all of the people. Democrats say that these bills are just the start in making that happen, and they say that other bills will be happening in the future. But you know what? It's up to us to make them keep their word and make Michigan the most transparent and open state in the country. That's the change that we voted for.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
Time to wrap up another installment of The Left of Lansing. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast and also give it a 5-star rating. That would greatly help because you are the reason I keep doing this podcast. And I want everyone knowing how progressives are leading the change and the charge that we so desperately need here in Michigan after 40 years of Republican rule. Special thanks again to Darrell Slaughter from the Natural Resources Defense Council for coming back on here to discuss the clean and affordable energy bills that are being worked on in the state legislature. Please give your state senator and representatives a call and tell them that it's vital we pass this bill making the state carbon-free by at least 2040. And while you're at it, tell them to pass some meaningful transparency laws, which we voted for last year. Coming up next week, I will talk education and why we must invest more into our public schools, as Arlissa Hurd and Molly Sweeney from 482 Ford in Detroit will join me to talk more about that. If you recall, Democratic State Representative Dylan Wagella brought them up while he talked about compassion economics, and since he brought them up, I just cannot wait to talk with Molly and Arlissa more about what they do and the importance of what we can do to help our education system here in Michigan. Until then, have a safe and happy Halloween, and as always, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.